This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington is considering making Urbana's Civilian Police Review Board the model for a similar review board. But has the Urbana Board made a difference in that community?
The people that I've known over the years who have served on the board, I think it gives them some insight into what policing is about.
Bloomington is considering making Urbana's Civilian Police Review Board the model for a similar review board. GLT's Judy Valente talks with Urbana's Deputy Police Chief, Bryant Serafin. Get a preview of tomorrow's BN by the Numbers presentation from the Economic Development Council and hear about the Small Business Development Center at Illinois Wesleyan University following the closure of ISU's center. And GLT's Laura Kennedy walks you through a new art exhibit from artist Cynthia Kukla, inspired by the Greek islands. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's June 28th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A variety of community groups have become increasingly critical of the procedure for filing complaints against the Bloomington Police, as well as the way the department investigates its own officers. The City Council is considering establishing a citizen-led review board to monitor complaints and provide an appeals process. A model for the council is the City of Urbana's Civilian Police Review Board, established several years ago. But just how well has Urbana's review board worked? GLT's Judy Valente looked into the statistics compiled by the Urbana Review Board and talked with the deputy police chief there.
At first, the Urbana rank-and-file officers were skeptical about having a civilian police review board in the same way that Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Hefner has opposed the creation of a similar board here. But nearly 10 years after its establishment, the existence of the Urbana board seems to have produced little change, either in the number of complaints filed or in citizen requests for the board to review a police department decision concerning an officer's conduct. If anything, complaints have gone down, as have the number of appeals filed by citizens. That's even though the Urbana Department ruled in the officer's favor in the vast majority of cases. Still, Urbana Deputy Chief Bryant Serafin says the review board is an important check and balance on police conduct.
This ordinance creating the Civilian Police Review Board was passed back in 2007. So we've had this for, and then I believe it they actually came to fruition or came into existence in 2008. So we've had this for going on 10 years now, and I guess I would say a little before the more immediate dialogue of the last couple of years regarding some of community trust issues really surfaced. So we had this for quite a while. And with regards to, there wasn't necessarily a salient point or an event, but I think it kind of came about. I believe it was an idea of one of the past mayors, Laurel Pressing, and it had some traction with the community. Mayor Pressing used to describe it as a sort of a good housekeeping seal of approval on the department that there was some civilian oversight.
What was the reaction of the police department and the police chief at the time? Were they for this or were they originally opposed? Did they have to be brought along?
I think the police department was maybe apprehensive, might be the word, at least from the line officers. Chief Adair at the time was not afraid of it. He had come from the Memphis, Tennessee Police Department, had been a commander there prior to coming to Urbana. He had a little more experience with these types of things, and he wasn't afraid of it. And I think it took a little time to kind of just get the officers aware of the process, sort of how it worked. I know there were some labor contract issues that had to be addressed, and but at this point, it hasn't been an issue for the officers.
What were the labor contract issues that had to be addressed?
One of the issues was whether or not the Civilian Police Review Board could subpoena and order officers to appear before them. And in Urbana, Illinois, the Civilian Police Review Board does not have that authority. And then it had to do with the officers appearing before them, and that the CPRB is more of an appeals-based process, but they don't conduct their own investigations.
That is correct. That's similar to what Bloomington is proposing. How about the number of complaints about police in Urbana since the review board got up and running, say, in 2000, looks like maybe it had its first full year in 2008, 2009. Have complaints gone up? Have complaints gone down? Have they basically stayed the same?
Complaints have basically stayed the same. The complaints filed for 2010, which was the year that that you'd chosen as sort of a levelized starting point, we actually had 10 complaints filed. In 2016, we had 7 complaints filed.
What does that say to you?
I don't believe it says much of anything, and while I haven't brushed up on my college statistics anytime soon, I don't believe that fall off is statistically significant, and I don't think we can make a whole lot of generalizations from that one way or the other.
How about appeals requested? Have appeals gone up?
The appeals for the CPRB review, in 2010 we had 1, and in 2016 there were 0 appeals that went before that were moved on to the CPRB phase of the complaint process.
How do you view that? Do you view that as people were satisfied with the disposition of their complaints when the police department made its determination, or maybe people didn't have trust in the review board?
I don't know exactly the answer to that. I would like to think that after going through the investigation process, and there's usually time spent between the complainant and the police department, and there's usually there's a lot more information given to the complaining party. Hopefully, after all that, they have been satisfied, but I can't tell you for certain.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm talking with Deputy Chief Brian Serafin of the Urbana Police Department about that city's Civilian Police Oversight Board. Of the complaints that were filed, say, in 2010 and 2016, the 10 complaints in 2010 and the 7 in 2016, how many were found to be unfounded by the police department?
Well, here's what I'll do. I will make sure that you understand at least what the dispositional codes or phrases are so that we use the same language when we have this discussion. So when someone has filed a complaint with us, that we have essentially 5 different dispositions. There's proper conduct, there's improper conduct, there's policy failure, where now the officer did what they were supposed to, but the outcome wasn't ideal because of policy should probably be reworked. They did, that was the breakdown. We will also then have insufficient evidence, where we simply at this point couldn't determine enough one way or the other, or there's an unfounded complaint where the events didn't occur as described. So with regards to 2010, of those complaints, we had 1 that was unfounded, 2 where we determined it was proper conduct. We had 1 that had 2 sub-issues within it, and I say that because 1 had 2 dispositions of proper conduct and insufficient evidence all within the same singular 1 complaint. 4 were insufficient evidence, and then we had 2 where it was where it's been closed as no finding, where we had no further contact with the complaining party, and 1 is actually still pending from 2010 because the person is in prison. That's the 2010 results. In 2016, of the 7 complaints, 3 were unfounded, 4 were proper conduct.
That follows pretty much the pattern of Bloomington, in that most of the complaints are found in favor of the officer. Now, let's go back to the review board itself and membership. Has Urbana had difficulty recruiting members for this? And if so, what kinds of difficulty?
I don't believe that there's been an issue. I haven't heard that, but I honestly I don't know.
Has there ever been controversy about someone who was nominated by the mayor but not accepted by the council, for example, or not accepted by the community?
No.
overall, how would you say the Civilian Review Board has been working in Urbana?
Oh, I think it's been working just fine. The officers aren't nearly as concerned about it as they were 10 years ago when we started going down this road. I think it works well in trying to make sure that we're being open and transparent and have an extra layer of review. I think the community, the people that I've known over the years who have served on the board have, I guess, enjoyed their participation in this. I think it gives them some insight into what the policing is about, because there's like a training component and certain amount of ride-along time and some other things they have to do so that they are educated as they sit in their CPRB chairs.
Do you think that the community has gained better trust, better confidence in the police department?
I don't have quantitative data to support that, but I believe the answer is yes. What I can say is that the Urbana experience has generally been positive. It's been a non-issue for us with regards to the officers, and I think it's positive for the community. But I guess each community is a little bit different, and they'll have to make their best decision on what they will think will work for their town.
Chief Serafin, I want to thank you for talking about all of this.
You're quite welcome. Thanks for having me.
I'm Judy Valente.
Civilian review boards have proved controversial in some cities. Cleveland's Police Review Board was criticized by the U.S. Justice Department in 2014 for a lack of transparency. The New York Civil Liberties Union complained that New York's board has been co-opted by the city's police department. Still, the watchdog group, the National Association for Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement, says review boards do play an important role in holding officers accountable, in keeping records of complaints, identifying necessary policy changes, and building public trust in law enforcement. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
For GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. After Illinois State University cut its Small Business Development Center last year, a new one has opened at Illinois Wesleyan University. Director Karen Busoni is the keynote speaker for tomorrow's BN by the Numbers event hosted by the Economic Development Council. In this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Busoni says the center opened in late March and things are going very well.
We now have over 30 clients that we are serving at the Small Business Development Center here at Illinois Wesleyan, and the number is continuing to increase as I'm speaking to you.
What are these folks going into or enlarging?
Restaurant businesses, hair salon. There's an idea about an article that helps prevent odors and sweat from getting on various surfaces, if you will. There's just all kinds of various concepts. It's amazing. But I'm seeing more and more restaurant startup. And some of the concepts with restaurants are somewhat of a niche market.
What do these folks not know? What's their biggest commonality in gaps of knowledge about starting a business?
How to write a business plan. Or that's what they're thinking, that they don't have the skill set. They are rather intimidated by writing a business plan. We formally go through the components of a business plan, and it puts clients more at ease, or that's what they're telling us. I think they're thinking this is a huge dinosaur that needs to be 40 pages in length, and it's just a daunting task to complete, and it's really not. But it does help you organize your thoughts and prepare you, especially for a conversation with a financial institution or angel investors. But it also helps you identify various components of a business plan that are extremely important, such as your target market. Is there demand for the concept that you've developed? Those are some of the first things we talk to people about. We also talk about feasibility as well. Most people have thought about the fact that they may not turn a profit for 2 or 3 years and they have to work long hours. They've thought through those kinds of things, and that's great, but it's the business plan write-up that tends to be what they what clients need help with.
As any community considers economic development, a lot of the headlines go to the external efforts. What's the case for reversing that and putting the lion's share of effort toward people already in the community?
I think it needs to be a balance of both, Charlie. The Economic Development Center or Council actually goes out and tries to find businesses to come here. And they try to find various accommodations for those individuals. And I think that's important to do that. One of my concerns is, though, as I'm seeing, in particularly the restaurant industry continuing to grow in town, you know, it's an interesting statistic. Bloomington Normal has more restaurants per capita than any metropolitan area in the United States, and we're continuing to see more and more restaurants pop up, which is great from an economic vantage point, but what's it, the corporate type entity, what's it going to do to the mom and pop shops as far as restaurants go? That's my concern, because we're seeing a lot of this corporate entity come to town in the form of restaurants. And so we are working that part of the agenda diligently here at the SBDC, because our mission is to help small business owners, existing owners, and new entrepreneurs as well. But I think that will offer an appropriate balance. It just seems now we're heavy on the side of more of that corporate entity coming from the outside in.
Illinois State University used to have the Small Business Development Center. Now Illinois Wesleyan does. Is there going to be a difference in emphasis in any way, or is this just a transition?
The emphasis at Illinois Wesleyan, I wasn't at Illinois State, so I can't speak to the emphasis there, but the emphasis at Illinois Wesleyan is we are developing partnerships with the Economic Development Council, with the Chamber of Commerce, with the local SCORE chapter, and then we have the SBDC. So four key players in the community to help drive economic growth. And another feature of this SBDC that is at Illinois Wesleyan University is to keep faculty and staff here at the university updated and informed on what is going on with the SBDC, what we're doing, and especially faculty, in that we're going to offer students internships, and not students just in business or accounting or economics, but students across any discipline possible at Illinois Wesleyan that can serve a client well, and it gives a student a great opportunity to learn various things that the client has. Maybe it's an issue the client's having with their shop, and maybe their shop focuses more on music products, for example, or theater, something to do with that type of venue, for example. And it would be very appropriate to maybe perhaps find a music major that would best fill that opportunity if that's an interest they have in the future with their career. So to do that, my assistant director, Caitlin Hill, and myself are staying very close to faculty to keep them informed by attending faculty meetings as they return back to school, and making sure they're updated with our newsletter. Plus, we have faculty members that actually provide some counsel to us regarding questions we have based upon matters that our clients bring to us. We have three business law professors here at Illinois Wesleyan, and they've been great, have served as great resources to us as we've asked questions about intellectual property. We have a full accounting staff, and we've had some questions about financial statements and specific details as it relates to tax law that we've been able to refer to one of our accounting professors, and they're very eager to help too. So that's the model that is that I'm building here.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Karen Busoni, the director of the Small Business Development Center at Illinois Wesleyan University, with two people on staff and with 30 clients. When will you top out? How many can you possibly serve at any given time?
There's not a number I have in mind that I can't serve. We'll find a way to serve them, Charlie. This SBDC has annual goals of clients to serve across the entire year. We started March 27th. We don't have a full year to reach what an average goal may be for other SBDCs, but that's, we are striving to reach a goal of roughly 70 clients before the end of the year to be seen for this year.
We hear about millennials taking a different approach to life and to careers. We hear about the gig economy. How different is starting a small business in today's world than it was a decade or so ago?
Starting a business today is not that much different than years ago, Charlie, from my perspective anyway, and what I've studied, what I've researched, and my upbringing was on family farms back in West Central Illinois. And that is a family-owned business that's still thriving, and it's about work ethic. And it's about education, continuing to have a desire to learn new things and reaching out to networks to find opportunities that you didn't realize may exist within your business or within your concept. I went to an event yesterday at the Chamber of Commerce called Solopreneur. It was a group of 18-20 people that gather once a month. They're small business owners, and they network, and they talk about various issues and whatnot. And it was a great opportunity for everyone that was there. There was networking going on before my presentation. I presented, lots of great questions were asked during the presentation. And then after the presentation, people continue to stay and network. And that's a part of being a business owner. You have to focus on your business, yes, but you have to network with people and be open to ideas from others and share ideas about your experiences as well. And I don't think that has changed from 50 years ago to the present day. But millennials have a different way of communicating with people. And actually, there are lots of positives in that they use social media a great deal. But millennials are very, very interested in starting up businesses. There's research out there available from Jason Dorsey of the Center for Generational Kinetics. And the implication is that all of the millennials that were canvassed for this research, 68% of them said that they had already owned or have been a part of a startup business. And almost 60% of them said that with the right idea and resources, they would start a business within the next year. So there's a lot of motivation, it seems as if, from millennials to start up businesses. They would rather do that than go work in corporate America. The millennials are different and definitely one of our target markets here in McLean County. It's millennials and Gen X's. So having tremendous amount of communication available through social media channels, and website management is extremely important for those individuals to gain knowledge of what we're about and who we are, and likewise with any other business. I found it very interesting, the research I read about millennials as it relates to entrepreneurial potential. 45% of them claim that the biggest barrier to them in starting a business is the access to capital. If I was a financial institution, I think I might weigh heavy into that in trying to find clients. And it's risky, too. But on the other hand, there's a lot of millennials out there interested in entrepreneurship and starting businesses.
Karen Busoni is the director of the Small Business Development Center located on the third floor of State Farm Hall on the campus of IWU. It's on the web at iwu.edu/SBDC. Busoni talked with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Also part of the BN by the Numbers quarterly briefing tomorrow from the Economic Development Council is economist Mike Doherty. GLT's Charlie Schlenker has that interview as well. He talks with Doherty about workforce and business trends. Doherty starts with the sales tax picture.
Well, it's looking good, actually. If you combine Bloomington Normal together, it was a 3% gain in the first quarter of 2017 compared to the first quarter of 2016. We'd waffled along sort of flat previously, so it was good to see this gain.
That's not to say there haven't been winners and losers. How do the two communities of Bloomington Normal fare, respectively?
Funny you should ask, because Normal was down by 3% on the quarter-over-quarter basis, looking at the first quarter of this year compared to first quarter of last year, whereas Bloomington was up by over 7%. So it was kind of Bloomington pulling the cart this time.
Why is that, do you think?
I don't know, except that the last numbers we were looking at last year for the retail sales numbers based on the sales tax revenues, Bloomington was down and Normal was doing better or more consistently. So sometimes things just shift back as part of a compensatory response.
How does Bloomington Normal compare to other metro areas across the state?
You know, all of them in the downstate have had decreases in employment. Bloomington Normal has done reasonably well, and especially compared to the Illinois average, their employment numbers were up over the last couple months, and that was contrary to the state as a whole. So relatively, we consistently do better than Decatur, than Peoria. We're about even with sometimes Springfield had a few gains in the past year or two that we did not see, small percentage increases in the economy, but not any big difference. Champaign-Urbana, we're oftentimes even with.
Let's talk about the size of the workforce and the number of people who are out of work and looking for a job. In that latter category, it held steady over the last 2 months at about 3,700 people, give or take. But over the last 3 months, there was a shift. About 600 people left the jobless rolls for one reason or another. Do we know what's happening there?
Well, if we look at for Bloomington Normal combined for March, from March to April, there was a decrease of only 355, according to the BLS stats that just came out. And that's fairly insignificant. That's, you know, given the base number, that's almost a 0% change.
The numbers I had were Illinois Department of Employment Security, and those may have been unadjusted.
Could have been. I do know they do for both employment and unemployment. They do a seasonal adjustment. These were unadjusted as well. This is the BLS updated numbers that I just looked at.
So it's an improvement, but not really a huge one in the number of jobless.
The picture I'm seeing from the BLS numbers for Bloomington Normal is that, first of all, we had one of the biggest decreases in unemployment in the state. We had an almost 1% decrease just since last November. All the metro areas in central Illinois have had a decrease in unemployment rate. So fewer people out there looking for a job. Now, one way that that sometimes happens is you also, right along with that, have fewer people in the labor force. So you have people just saying, well, I'm not looking, but I'm also not working.
Is that a matter of retirements?
Yes. So that, one of the factors on that, there can be several big factors on that. Number one is the age of your population, retirements. But the other one is if the economy is doing very poorly and you have wages and salaries being offered that don't cover the cost of living, some people just drop out and decide that I might as well stay home and take care of, maybe be a stay-at-home parent, maybe go back to school part-time or something else because I'm not going to earn enough to be worth the transaction costs to be out there working.
The so-called discouraged workers.
Discouraged workers.
But the economy is not doing that badly.
Exactly. So I would argue that to whatever extent we've had we've had this slight decrease in labor force in Bloomington Normal, it's in line with the decreases we've seen in other metro areas, and that it's in line with the aging population. So I think that's all it is. I think it's simply demographics, and I don't think it's anything else. And in fact, to that point, if you look at the labor force participation broken down by age groups, and you compare Bloomington Normal to the surrounding big metro areas, our labor force participation rates are noticeably higher in the 16 to 19-year-olds and in the 45 to 55-year-olds. Two categories that across the U.S. and in Illinois generally are low. We're actually higher than average in those.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Mike Dougherty of the Economic Development Council about BN by the Numbers coming up. 16 to 19-year-olds, though, is that a function of there are more opportunities for those kids with the college kids leaving town for the summer?
Could be. It means there's jobs out there for them. It usually also means that the wages are pretty good for those jobs. Otherwise, our participation rates for those teenagers would be the same as the other metros. It would be lower than it is. So it's higher for some reason, which means we're probably paying a little more around here for that kind of labor.
Why are we doing that? Because college kids in the rest of the year want a higher wage, and it transfers to teenagers when the college kids aren't here, or what?
What do you think? Maybe it's just the parents in Bloomington Normal pushing their kids, you know, out there to get jobs. I don't know. I'm not sure. No.
So this is suggesting that the economy is doing pretty well in the Twin Cities and in McLean County as a whole.
Especially if you like really low unemployment rates. So people are busy here. We have a tight labor market situation here. So that's always good news for most people.
In economics 101 and 102, micro and macro, mm-hmm. back in college days, there is this idea of the lowest floor that you can get to in an employment rate.
Right.
At 3.8 or 3.7%, are we there?
Yeah, almost any economist would agree that that's almost excessive unemployment, that you're really going to be pushing up. You're going to basically have to attract people to move here or get people to increase productivity because you're just running out of people.
Do the rules about full employment really apply anymore, though, because of the aging baby boomers and the retirements that we're going through?
Yeah, there's a lot of arguments, as you are alluding to, between economists about how low can unemployment go. Some people say it ought to be higher because of the aging population. There's arguments of that. There's arguments that it ought to be lower than it was in the past, lower than 3.7% or whatever, because of the fluidity of the labor market with people being able to go online and immediately see exactly how many jobs are open and the job announcements. It used to be, it took a lot of time. You had to sometimes even go to a public library and find a newspaper and go through classified ads. And that increased that quote-unquote natural rate.
The velocity of people.
Yeah.
Well, what about the gig economy? How does that affect unemployment rates?
And there are a lot of questions about the degree to which we can still measure in the way that we used to and measure employment and unemployment. How do we know that people are not seeking a job in Bloomington Normal, but yet are doing something constructive, maybe even with pay, over the internet with clients that are, you know, in another community or even overseas? As we move toward a more cyber economy, it does become more of a challenge to know how to measure that and to feel confident in those figures.
Let's look for the rain cloud in this silver lining here. With such a low unemployment rate, does it make the Economic Development Council's job more difficult to attract yep. new businesses by saying, well, you don't have much of a free labor force?
Yes. In a word, it does make their job more difficult. New businesses, startups are very, that's one of the first things they look at is labor availability. And of course, there's adjustments based on what kind of labor is available. We've got a good educated, a high educated labor force here. That's why our wages are higher. And I think that's why we're having higher labor force participation. But to your point, you know, I think it makes it very difficult to expand when you've virtually every able-bodied person is working already because you got to bid them away from that job.
What should the EDC and the Chamber of Commerce types and the city development officials do about this?
Take away from this? I would say if you're going to recruit businesses, you better be recruiting businesses that have high wages because a low-wage business generally are businesses that use a lot of person hours per unit of output. And so you cannot afford to pay very high wages with those like those kinds of businesses. So you really ought to be trying to attract like your higher tech or computer related businesses that they can bid away the person who has maybe a degree from ISU but is working retail somewhere. They can bid that person away because of what they can afford to pay because of their productivity.
Mike Dougherty has BN by the Numbers. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charlie.
I'm Charlie Schlinger.
Mike Dougherty gives his BN by the Numbers quarterly presentation at 11:30 tomorrow at ISU's Bone Student Center. The EDC will have more detail on real estate, sales taxes, and other aspects of the economy. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
If you want to start something, start strong.
Call me Ishmael.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Join in the fun at the first ever GLT Bocce at the Village, September 9th at Normandy Village.
In a hole in the ground lived a hobbit.
Once upon a time, there was a pair of pants.
Get your team together now for this friendly competition.
It was a dark and stormy night.
It's the first ever GLT Bocce at the Village. It'll be one for the books. More info at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A retired Illinois State University art professor hasn't put her feet up since leaving the classroom. Rather, she's gone exploring through Greece to create works for a new exhibit currently on display at the McLean County Arts Center in Bloomington. Laura Kennedy has more.
The Art Center's Armstrong Gallery is lined with works depicting classical architecture and sculptures from ancient Greece. On the far end of the gallery, hundreds of dried flowers are festooned before a large, burnished silver altar. Curated by the center's Alfonso Gonsalves, To the Sacred Grove is the latest works from artist Cynthia Kukla. It features sculptures as well as Kukla's usual medium, watercolor. She immersed herself in the culture of ancient Greece after being a visiting professor three different times at Aristotle University of Thessaloniki.
During times where I wasn't teaching, I would make research trips to Athens or Delphi or Crete. I spent a whole week in Crete, Istanbul, various places throughout Greece. In this way, I could literally sit in front of the temple at Delphi or in front of the Sphinx, the Great Sphinx. Actually, it's in the museum, and they let me paint with watercolors in there, which is amazing, because normally you can't paint with watercolors in a museum. I was a scholar visitor, and so I had a special ID from the Ministry of Culture, so that was helpful.
How did you decide on what you wanted to paint? I mean, there's just so much in Greece and so many ruins there.
You're right. It would take several lifetimes. Because I was in northern Greece, as my starting point, I was in Thessaloniki. And when you think of St. Paul's letter to the Thessalonians, which is from the New Testament, Thessaloniki is a very old city, and it's on the Roman road, the Egnatia. And so The starting point was the temple of Isis Taichi, and some of the images are from there. So that was my starting point. It's a lesser-known temple, and the main show in the gallery there features more of that. So I was starting out in northern Greece and kind of central Greece, and then I made my first research trip to Delphi. And then eventually I made my way to Athens.
With all this history and with all this culture right around you, how did it hit you emotionally as an artist?
It was overwhelming. Everywhere I'd go, I'd be walking on marble steps that had a beautiful indentation. And some of the marble steps had inscriptions on them because they had been part of other things long in disarray that the workmen or craftsmen or architects would have reused. And so anywhere you looked, there was some piece of some human's effort, whether it was ancient writing or a fragment of stone carving, just a piece of a relief carving that had just a head and a hand. It was overwhelming. There was so much.
Alfonso, can I ask you a question? Why did you want to show this work by Cynthia's here at the McLean County Arts Center?
Well, the McLean County Arts Center is very happy to show Cynthia Kukla's work. First of all, because we were interested in showing more figurative work and something that had to do with emotion and spirituality in a way. And I think she's the perfect artist for that.
So what have you discovered looking at her works? What have you discovered about the spirituality of her works?
Well, I think she's planning on having a very concise idea of how to enjoy and understand her work by having an idea of where the show starts and where it ends. So that kind of path, that kind of way to go is going to make that very evident.
So it's almost like a pilgrim's journey through the artwork.
Somehow, yes, it is.
Exactly.
Yes.
Do you want to go inside?
Yeah, show me. Let's go in. Oh, there's flowers all over the place. There's dried roses.
Over 200 dozen dried roses.
Where do you get 200 dozen dried roses?
Thanks to Kroger, the one on College Avenue, as well as two in Northern Kentucky, where I now live. When roses are expired, I wrote a letter, got the manager's approval, explained the purpose for this solo exhibition, and they were happy to donate expired roses to me. These were ones that were going to go into the trash and hang them upside down in my studio, and sometimes we would get 40 dozen at a time. So it takes hours to process 40 dozen long-stem roses. And I wanted this to have a sense of memory, a sense of a memorial. The piece in the back, the silver-leafed sculpture part, is meant to give an impression of an ancient altar.
Yes.
where one is making an offering.
Where do we start our pilgrim's journey when we come into the Armstrong Gallery?
I think you start in your own memory, in your own place. And I think no matter what your level of spiritual interest is, we all have loved ones, whether it's our grandparents or our favorite uncle or aunt, people who perhaps have already passed. And I'm hoping that the roses trigger a sense of memory for those people who we have loved very much. And in fact, you know, this is probably a tribute to my own father who died when I was in graduate school. And so I had done a rose series in tribute to him, and people keep asking me to bring back my rose series. This time, I literally thought to myself, I'm going to use real roses. I just have to. I've been obsessed with this altar for about 4 years. I mean, I was trying to figure out how I wanted to make the image inside of it, because it's obviously just the impression of a real altar.
It has an old master's quality to it, if I may.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That was the point, because that's actually based on the altar of peace in Rome, which is called Ara Pacis. So that's the Mother Earth flanked by the goddess of the land and the goddess of the sea. And so I used silver leaf to give the, as I was explaining it to somebody, they said, oh, as if seen in moonlight. And I said, oh my gosh, yes, that's exactly what I wanted. So all the other paintings at the front of the gallery are meant to give you the impression of you're seeing it perhaps at dusk, or it's your memory, because our memories aren't really in color. When we think about it, our memories are not in high-keyed color, or even our dreams. We dream things, but they're not in big old technicolor. So we tend to have a kind of muted sense of things we remember. And so these paintings in the front are muted.
Alfonso, for the gallery goer who comes in to see this show, what advice can you give them? What to look for? What to anticipate?
Well, I would recommend to start a conversation between you, yourself, and the piece that you are beholding at that moment. I think that's the only advice I would give, because it's an experience that needs you as participant. That's very important. Sometimes people don't spend much than 1 minute watching images, but sometimes artists are challenging you to be curious and spend more than those 2 minutes. Nowadays, we have a world surrounded by images, and it's all the time overwhelming, but I think artists are offering that challenge to spend time and start a conversation with the piece.
Do you think people will be surprised to walk in here and find all these dried roses all over the
place? I think so, yeah. I mean, it was also surprising even for me as curator. I didn't expect this, but I think it's coming along, it works, and it's exciting. Yeah, definitely.
Well, this isn't just the Armstrong Gallery, you guys. This is the Flora Armstrong Gallery. Did you notice that?
No, I didn't. Oh, that's perfect. That is perfect. Thank you for pointing that out. There we go. The goddess Flora, here she is.
You know, Cynthia, looking at some of your works, some of them are they're very simple lines with simple color choices. I mean, very direct and very bold. And then we have more color coming in, like with this vase down here at the end of the gallery. We have a lot more color coming in and more vibrancy. Can you tell me about your choices with regards to that?
That's excellent that you notice that. As you get closer on your journey to the Sacred Grove and you come to the place where you're going to make your offering, there is more living color, and it's more in harmony with the roses that are seen here below. So this whole piece is really a sculptural installation. I'm known primarily as a painter, but I have done a number of sculptures. I wanted the viewer to be drawn toward the place that is the quietest place, where one would think of people who you have loved. There are places where people would kneel and say prayers if they wished, or just hold their hands in front of themselves and think for a minute. And then if you look up, you see something that was possibly a beautiful statue that was in the Sacred Grove that you caught a glimpse of. So that's the impression I want to give.
So we have all the dried flowers, these offerings here in the Sacred Grove. How do you feel about people coming in here and leaving their own offerings?
Ooh, that's interesting. Well, they could. They could.
They might be inspired to be a part of it.
I believe so. I mean, I think that the offering would be just to be capable to connect with the show, and I would be really happy if that happens. I think Cynthia has the best work for that to happen, actually.
That would be my next piece, because I want to make more. This is great. I already want to make more altars. I'm so obsessed with this. And of course, the rose part, it's a lot of work. And I could imagine one where the next one would have a different title. You've just opened up such a Pandora's box, girl. You notice how there's little bits of cellophane, which is contemporary? I wanted people to think about the tributes that were given at Sandy Hook, or in Orlando, or in London. I wanted people to think about different memorial places that are part of our contemporary life.
So here we are surrounded by ancient imagery, but the memorials are things that are never left in the past.
Correct, correct. There, every moment, there is somebody who has something that it could be something tragic, or it could be something lovely. And in these times, we have some pretty tragic events and memorials. And I didn't want this installation to be to hit you over the head with a real heavy political statement, and yet it is there. My work has always had an undercurrent of concern, a humanism. I think roses trigger a lot of associations. I think that alone will help people make their own journey, mental journey, spiritual journey, seeing this show.
That's artist Cynthia Kukla, along with curator Alfonso Gosalvez. To the Sacred Grove is currently up and continues at the McLean County Arts Center in Bloomington through July 29th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
See a slideshow of the exhibit at our website, wglt.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast or our individual interviews, today with help from Judy Valente, Charlie Schlenker, and Laura Kennedy. Our website is also where you can find contact information to let us know what you think of this show. We also want to know what you think of Sound Ideas at our Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/WGLTFM. This is GLT and WGLT.org, 89.1 FM, Bloomington Normal's public media.